From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we talk about the ripple effect on a person's life when facing eviction. Then our annual Games to Gift conversation looks at some of the best games of 2020 and how this atypical year has impacted the gaming world.
The biggest trend directly resulting from the pandemic is the movement online for a lot of tabletop gaming. More people are playing role-playing games on Zoom and Roll20 and different tabletop platforms.
Plus, Daniel Golden of Boswell Books joins us for our yearly Books to Gift segment and says one book is especially relevant today.
Imagines the life of Shakespeare's family. And one of the interesting things about Shakespeare is that he lived through, to give it a parallel today, he lived through the plague.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The COVID-19 pandemic has threatened economic stability for many Milwaukeeans. But for renters, there has been some protection. That thin safety net halting some evictions is due to dissolve at the end of the year without congressional action. Which means there is a looming eviction crisis hanging over the heads of a lot of Wisconsin households. But there's more to being evicted than just losing your shelter. It's a stain on your rental record that makes it more difficult to find housing again. For families, it can also mean uprooting children from their school system while trying to maintain your dignity. Deb Hefner is the Housing Strategy Director at Community Advocates. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about what eviction looks like and how it touches every aspect of a person's life.
We're looking at a possible looming eviction crisis in the Milwaukee area and across Wisconsin, across the country. What are the options for people who have been protected by a moratorium but are at risk because of that expiring?
Well, I think it's important to note that, you know, the eviction crisis isn't new. This is something that has been happening now for quite some time. And as a result, Community Advocates and our partners have been really working to be able to address it. Unfortunately, COVID has really taken it into like unprecedented levels. The one positive thing is the amount of support has greatly increased. So if there was a loss of income, we do have rent assistance available still. Community Advocates, we administer the county the Milwaukee County CARES Act dollars. And the criteria there for rent assistance is just really needing to show that loss of income, and there's specific income eligibility criteria as well. But we are just wanting to make sure that anyone who is afraid of not being able to make their rent is aware that this exists and that they reach out to us. And then beyond that, we, as I just mentioned, have been working to create this Rental Housing Resource Center with a total of 9 partners from all different facets of, housing stability work. And we're trying to be able to help the individual as a whole because there's so many factors that come into play. So in a nutshell, there is help and there is support. So we want to make sure people are aware of that.
Absolutely. And thinking about eviction and the amount of things that it can affect, what are the ripple effects of being evicted?
Well, it's terrible. I mean, there's a lot of obviously health and mental health and physical health ramifications. Just in terms of the stress that happens as a result, there's adverse effects on children. But your home is arguably one of the most important things about someone's life. So if there is a chance that you may not know where you're going to be living, or even just the stress of thinking about that, obviously it's going to affect all facets of your life as well. Those health effects, but then also just the ramification of the eviction itself, because unfortunately it's like just this X on your record that makes it really challenging to be able to get future places. I mean, it's very similar to credit, and it's just unfortunate that often people that are already vulnerable are those who face that, and then it just has this effect, like you said, a ripple effect that just makes it that much more difficult to be able to obtain housing in the future, or quality housing that everybody deserves.
Yeah, of course. And Deb, as you and your colleagues at Community Advocates understand, an eviction crisis isn't always immediately seen or understood by people not directly affected.
Yeah.
So from someone working in your field, how would you visualize what eviction looks like in a person's life?
Well, I get emotional thinking about that. You know, and I'm newer to housing as well. But I mean, I think, you know, you can see the pictures, and if you work in the city, you've even encountered this, like driving, that, you know, you drive past a place where there's just all the belongings that are sitting in front of the home. And if you think about that, you know, and I mean, everybody, like I said, like, you know, housing is such an important part of everyone's world and life. And then, you know, your things are obviously what's in your house. So just to be able to see that, I think it just resonates with the loss, you know, and that this is someone's entire life that's just being completely uprooted. And I think it's important that you know, that people can see that and have empathy towards that, because again, it's something that everyone can relate to. It's their home, you know.
That's a really powerful mental image, that, because I think what makes a house a home, you think about all the ways that you create a home, and seeing that fractured in front of someone's, what was their home?
I think the other thing of it too is just in talking to tenants, you know, that are on the verge of eviction, it's like this fear that, like, I really haven't encountered before. I mean, because, you know, there's just, it's so urgent. And obviously, like with everything, you know, things take time, assistance takes time. But for that person, that doesn't matter, because this is their entire life, you know? So it's just that balancing act of realizing that there's so many, you know, emergency situations, but to that person, that is their emergency situation, and making sure that it's, you know, viewed, and that there's just dignity involved in that as well. And I think that's where the Rental Housing Resource Center especially will come into play, because again, it's like the whole gamut of services, and really being able to look at the individual and figure out, like, what is the root of the problem, and be able to help that way.
Well, then I can't help but think about all the other things that are just naturally difficult. Say if you're moving to a different place, getting your license and getting all these other things established that you have to have an address for.
Right. So something as simple as that. Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you know, enrolling in school. Like, I mean, I've talked to desperate tenants who are like, I need to get my kids enrolled in school. It's so obviously in the midst of a pandemic, I mean, the fact that these, you know, the majority of children are learning virtually, if you don't have a home right there, you know, that's going to be extremely challenging. And so there's just so many facets in normal everyday life, and then, you know, piled COVID on top of it, and it's just that much more challenging and scary, because obviously there's never been a more important time for someone to maintain stable housing. You know, the other thing I want to mention too is just, you know, with, you know, I keep talking about the downsides of COVID, but that, like, you know, the upsides are that we really have, in addition to being able to get our Rental Housing Resource Center off the ground, we've been able to talk to so many landlords. And I think you know, we've always taken the approach of, like, we have to work together. It's not adversarial, you know, our relationships, but it's just been able to provide new opportunities to communicate and, you know, come around the same table. And so much of it is just about education. And, like, you know, you just, that question you asked me was just so important about how someone that maybe not has experienced this can really see what it's like, and just being able to, you know, come around the table and just share, like, the version of, like, what we're seeing, and then, you know, find common ground. And there's exceptions to every rule, but the majority of landlords that we work with do want to be able to try and as well keep the tenant in the house. I mean, it's obviously advantageous to them as well. I mean, it's very costly to even file an eviction.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are experiencing and understanding how close someone can be to losing their housing than ever before. Do you feel like one of the other bright spots of COVID might be that the work that you all are doing, the challenges that you see every day in the community, are being seen by more people?
That's a really good point too. Yes, absolutely. And really, like, even thanks to, like, media, I feel like it's just been covered so much more. We're able to get the information out about the resources. a lot of people have read the book Evicted by Matt Desmond. And if you have not and you're listening, you should definitely read it to help understand the eviction crisis better. And what's interesting about that book is that it also takes place in Milwaukee. And they, Matt Desmond actually worked with community advocates, you know, as he wrote that book. But, you know, Evicted was like great in terms of being able to also like capture more interest and just be able to depict it. And then again, since COVID, I think there's just been a stronger focus on getting out the information on resources and just more awareness raising to not only the crisis, but the resources that exist to help the crisis.
The immediate challenge someone faces when being evicted is housing. Where are they going to find shelter? But what are the other somewhat unknown difficulties that eviction presents?
In terms of, you know, not knowing where you're going to go that night is obviously like the big pressing issue. But, you know, if you do have things and, you know, if they do get put on the street, like, you know, we have like a triage mechanism where we're thinking like, okay, so first of all, let's make sure that the person has a place to go that night, but then also that they have a place to take their things to, you know. And often those things are costly, though, too, like to be able to move things or if you don't have a vehicle. So it's just like working on those like logistics. But like safety, obviously, is the first huge part of it, and dignity as well, because like, you know, going back to that whole these are personal things and they're value, you know, they're valuable. So so that, and then beyond that, you know, focusing on a longer term solution. So oftentimes if someone has to move, obviously, it's going to be a quick move to something temporary. And so then we're going to try and work to figure out a relocation plan. And that's another thing of, you know, of COVID too, is that, you know, working to build more relationships with landlords and having like an increased willingness to possibly even rent to someone that has a past eviction, you know, on their record. But so relocating to a longer term thing, because the ultimate goal then is just to make sure that person does have safe and stable housing.
How do you work to help someone who feels that they've lost their dignity because of a housing issue, because of being evicted?
Yeah, I mean, I think regaining housing is, you know, is very important, and also just having like compassion and empathy. And I think, you know, it's very important to the way that we deliver our services that everyone that we're working with understands that, you know, they're not alone. I mean, I've actually heard, it's interesting because, you know, people say, I'm not a bad person. I'm like, I know you're not a bad person. I mean, you can have like, you know, you can be making, you know, a pretty decent salary, and something can happen and it can spur. I mean, COVID's been an example of that too, you know? So, and unfortunately, you know, people of color are often disproportionately affected by this, and women as well. And it's, you know, just important for people to be aware that, you know, this is not exclusive to them, and that there's systematic issues involved as well. I think that hopefully helps as well. And just advocating, I think, for change, you know, on a policy level too is important, because, you know, you can help the individual, but there's obviously things that need to be changed, you know, policy-wise that could make, a difference for the broader population.
What are your concerns for what happens if the eviction moratorium ends as it is scheduled to do?
Well, so, and that's an interesting one. So the eviction moratorium, you know, first it was the statewide one. Currently we have the CDC federal moratorium. It is good in the short term, you know, in terms of helping us to be able to keep, you know, tenants like stable in the moment. But unfortunately, it's not a rent freeze. And, you know, it has a trickle effect. Like if a tenant's not able to pay their rent, the landlord is not able to pay their mortgage. And it's like, it's kind of like the food chain, you know, it goes. And so I think it's, you know, really important to us to make sure that that people know that the resources exist, because rent assistance, really the level that we have right now can help to cure that arrear and make it so that, you know, they're once again in good standing, because unfortunately come January, that rent is still going to be owed. You know, as we all know, Wisconsin's the coldest, January is the coldest month of the year in Wisconsin. So it's just going to be that much scarier knowing that many people are in jeopardy of possibly losing their homes. So I think it's just more about getting the message out that, you know, this is not a rent freeze, and that, you know, just to seek help and resources, and do not be ashamed or embarrassed anytime, but especially not during this time, because, you know, this is why we exist, is to be able to try and help. And there's, you know, never been a more important time for us to be there.
And is the city of Milwaukee prepared for what could be a looming eviction crisis?
I don't think any city is prepared for what could be a looming eviction crisis. I mean, obviously shelters are filled, and, you know, I think that going back to, again, just to being, you know, Wisconsin and winter. And so I think it's scary. And I think, you know, hopefully there'll be, you know, another stimulus package that is passed that would bring in more increased resources. And we're so grateful to, you know, the county and the city of Milwaukee and the state that, you know, stepped up and you know, utilized their CARES dollars to be able to put towards rent assistance, because it really has been able to make the difference in this current moment. So it's really thinking about moving past January. And so, like, all fingers are crossed. But there's private, you know, because obviously not everybody is eligible for the you know, the federal dollars. So the other thing is, like, the philanthropy community, you know, has definitely stepped up. And you know, and so that, in that way, that's another positive, because the tension is there, and we've just been able to work with each other, and we're so grateful to be able to have these resources, because we obviously get to see the positive effects of being able to help that, you know, that person.
Deb Hefner is the Housing Strategy Director at Community Advocates. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about eviction and the ripple effects it has. Coming up next, we'll return with our annual Games to Gift conversation with gaming expert James Lauder. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The holiday season is in full swing, and many of us are already trying to figure out what to buy our loved ones. And although many of us will be avoiding extended family gatherings this year, there are still ways to stay connected, and gaming is one of them. Every year, gaming expert James Lauder gives us his picks for the best games to gift. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the top games of the year.
2020 has been such an atypical year, and for many of us, it's been a particularly lonely year since safe social gatherings are really limited by the pandemic. How has that impacted the gaming world, and what are some of the trends you've seen come out over this past year?
Well, the biggest trend directly resulting from the pandemic is the movement online for a lot of tabletop gaming. More people are playing role-playing games on Zoom and Roll20 in different tabletop platforms. Game companies are accelerating the use of online tools for people to build communities. And then there are games like Pursue the Pennant, the old stat-based baseball game developed in Brookfield, Wisconsin by Mike Sizlinski. They have moved almost entirely online, but the game has been developed so that you can play with the old tabletop boards as well. So that's been a big movement in the last year to compensate for and allow people to continue building their communities, even though the pandemic has isolated everybody.
You've split up the different kinds of games that we're going to talk about into their own categories. So let's start here with something that a lot of us can still do in person, two-player games.
Yes, we normally do party games. We left that out this year. So I offered a couple of two-player games instead. The first one is Nunami, and that's a really interesting design put together by three generations of an Inuit family. And it is a terrain management game played on 6 or 10 hexagonal boards. You use numbered cards. One player plays nature, one player plays humans, and you fill in the terrain hexagons, and then when they're completely filled with cards, you score them. And depending on who has majority control or who has the most points, players get a victory point, and the first player to 4 victory points wins.
So for people who have more than two people who they want to play with and can play with, you have a whole category of family games. What are some good games to gift this year in that category?
Family games are always great because the way I define them, the way they're generally looked at, are games that can play with a range of people, usually older kids, 8 to 10, 10 to 12, and then adults. And these are games that will engage everybody at the table. The parents won't get frustrated playing because the games are too simple. The kids won't be bored because the games are too long. The first one I mention is a game called Isle of Cats, which is published by City of Games. It's for 1 to 4 players, 8 and up. And you're citizens of Squall's End, and you are on a mission to the Isle of Cats to rescue as many cats in 5 turns as you can before the evil Lord Besh arrives and ends the game. The cats are sort of like oddly shaped dominoes, and being cats, of course, they are oddly shaped. And you've got to collect as many as you can and fit them onto the deck of your ship, which is gridded out. And you need to cover up certain rooms, and you need to cover up all of the ship's rats, or you lose points. And the cats, of course, don't necessarily cooperate because of shape here. You want to group them together in families. It's played over, like I said, 5 turns. It's very fast to play. It's got a solo mode. It's also got a family mode, as well as a hobby mode. The hobby mode, you do a little more resource management. The family mode simplifies the game a little bit. So if you're playing with younger kids, it plays faster and requires a few less decisions each turn. The second game this year is Cartographers, which is for ages 10 and up. Players, they list 1 to 99 based on the number of sheets available in the box, but really you want to probably play with 1 to 6. Players are cartographers sent to map the new northern kingdoms, the new northern lands by the queen. She has specific features that she wants to see in her new kingdom, which are noted in edict cards that all the players can see. You explore the new territory by flipping over cards, which will describe shapes that you need to draw into your map and then the terrain that you need to draw in with it. And each player can, based on the cards, usually choose 1 of 2 different things to put together. And they get to choose where the shapes go, so everybody's maps are completely different. You score based on those edict cards and some other things, like you may turn over a monster ambush. And when that happens, everybody switches maps and your rivals get to draw the monster ambush in on your map. And then you have to make sure you fill in around that or you lose points. So it's got that nice interactive aspect to it as well. It plays in, about half an hour, a little longer. And it's got that really nice art component to it as well. So that's a game that'll work for both adults and kids.
Now, these family games are really for the whole family, for adults, for kids. But if you're specifically playing with kids or for games that would be played just by kids, what are some good options?
Kids games are always tough. And the one thing to always keep in mind with kids games is that the rules can always be changed. When you pick up a game and you start playing, the rules can be changed to fit your family and fit your kids. Rules are not mandates, they are suggestions. So one of the games that has been out in the last couple of years is Wobble King. And this is a little bit of a throwback to the old Ideal games like Don't Break the Ice and things like that. It's partly physical challenge where you've got King Leo balanced atop a board, which is balanced atop some silver nuggets, little pieces of wood that are representing silver nuggets. And you use a stick to slide some of the nuggets out from under the board. But if you take too many out, King Leo tips and the whole board tips down and King Leo throws a tomato at you and you get a little tomato token. And the first person to get 2 tomato tokens loses. Everybody else wins. You know, if that's frustrating for your kids, you can come up with different victory conditions or co-op conditions. But it's a cleverly designed game and it's a fun little balancing game and plays for kids as young as 4. Another game, and this is a good one to consider during the pandemic, is The Color Monster, the board game based on the best-selling kids books. And this is a cooperative game in which The players move the monster around the board where he lands on spaces that have colored emotion tokens. And to pick up one of the tokens that represent happiness, sadness, anger, fear, the player has to describe a time they felt that emotion. Then they can pick up the emotion token. And what they try to do is put it in the correct jar. And this is, they're all color-coded. The jar colors are hidden. So there's a bit of a memory aspect to this as well. And the players win when they get all of the emotion tokens correctly sorted in all of the jars. And for kids that have been dealing with the pandemic, this is a great platform to be talking about feelings they may be dealing with. That's something that games can do as well.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm speaking with James Lauder. He is the executive editor for Chaosium, and we're talking about the best games to gift this year. Moving from games for younger players to really games for people who are in the know, hobby games. First of all, how would you describe these kinds of games, and what are your top picks for this year?
So hobby games differ from kids' games in that they tend to be for 12 or 14 and up. They differ from family games in that these are games that invite a depth of play. Family games tend to be playing a half an hour to an hour. They're very satisfying. They can have strategy to them, but it's not a game that necessarily invites a deep focus like chess or Magic the Gathering, because there are so many cards and so many different combinations that you can work out. That invites a deep level of play. So a good hobby game will do that. And this year, the first one is Gloomhaven Jaws of the Lion. And that is a prequel to the even more weighty and even more daunting Gloomhaven fantasy role-playing dungeon crawl where you're moving through the city, fighting your way through to goals. Jaws of the Lion takes a mercenary troop and simplifies the rules, quickens up the playtime. And one of the things about Gloomhaven, the main game is the tile laying for the board as you're setting up the game can be pretty time consuming. But the Jaws of the Lion gets around that by having the scenario booklet actually double as the play area as well. So as you open up, turn to new pages for the scenarios, that's the board that you're contending with. It's a very clever way to get around that time-consuming issue. And then Imperial Struggle is on the surface, a classic, gigantic, long 2 to 4 hour war game. In this case, you're playing either two players. You are playing France or England in the 18th century scramble to divide up the world and establish empire. It is by Ananda Gupta and Jason Matthews, who designed the classic Cold War war game Twilight Struggle back in 2005. And this uses some of the same mechanics. It's developed from that engine. It's not the same game. And it is a very sophisticated, long slog war game. One of the things that's really interesting about it is older games that handle topics like this tended to gloss over the history. So when you are looking at the conflict between the empires, the negative things that happened in history, the ugliness of imperialism would have been in an old Avalon Hill game generally, not something that the cards covered. They're covered directly in here. So you contend with slavery, you contend with oppression of the local populations. Even when you are working to do things in your peace phases, you are essentially working toward war. And so that makes it a really interesting way to deal with the historical realities of imperialism.
Well, this next category of games is often a subset of hobby games, RPGs, also known as role-playing games. For the uninitiated, role-playing games are essentially when the players take on a kind of character in the realm of the game. What are some of the top picks for this year?
This year, the two role-playing games I specifically picked, one is the Alien role-playing game from Free League, a Swedish game company that has sort of burst onto the scene recently. The Alien role-playing game is tied in with the movie franchise. You play space marines or space truckers who are contending with the aliens throughout science fiction. It's based on the same Year Zero game engine that their other games have been using. It's essentially a really great dark fantasy horror science fiction. They also released, and I list the main game here, it's a $50 hardcover, gives you everything you need to develop characters and play the game. They also released a starter set for the game. That's a big trend in role-playing games now. Different companies releasing starter sets. I mentioned three last year. There are others this year, Pathfinder and Starfinder from Paizo, both had great starter sets as well. All of those, if you're looking for gateways into role-playing games, all of those are fantastic options. For Aliens, either one will work. If you're looking for a way to introduce yourself to role-playing games, the Alien starter set is great. But the main role-playing game, if you're a little familiar with role-playing games, is a fantastic book. The Fiasco box set is sort of the other end of role-playing games. It's also a starter box, but Fiasco is a role-playing game. Well, it's not as far as you can possibly go, but it's pretty far along the spectrum away from the heavy, here's a $50 hardcover with tons of rules and lots of character generation and things like that. Fiasco plays as a role-playing game. It's sort of one part role-playing game, one part party game, and one part improv troop exercise. Using cards, you go through two acts describing something that went spectacularly wrong for the characters that the people at the table are playing. And the games play in a very short amount of time. You can play through a scenario in about half an hour. And it's designed to basically be a really fun, fast pickup that introduces the idea of role-playing, that this is your character, and using cards and then interacting with the other players at the table, you determine how the story is unfolding for that character.
Now, for, I guess, what you'd call the piece de resistance, what is your top game to gift for 2020?
Well, there was some temptation this year to pick one of the pandemic games. They're all marvelous, and we've mentioned them on the show in past years. The game that I did decide to pick for the top game this year was the new release of the Dune board game, originally published in 1979 by Avalon Hill. And it's very unusual to see a licensed game like this. It's tied in with the Frank Herbert science fiction novel. It's very unusual to see one of those get re-released, but because the new movie is coming out, the Gale Force 9 got the rights to re-release this game and actually brought back the original design team to put a newer edition together that streamlined some of the rules and fine-tuned things. It was a brilliant game to start with. This version of the game is even better. You are playing one of six factions who are vying for control of the planet Arrakis, or the planet Dune, and the flow of the spice melange on the world. It's an asymmetrical game where each one of the factions has different strengths and powers. There is negotiation, there is alliances, there's area control. It's got a lot going on. It's a lot of fun. It plays in about 2 hours. This leans toward the hobby game more than a family game, but I'm such a fan of this that I really felt like I had to include it.
We've talked a lot about how 2020 has been a really difficult year. What is your advice to people who are interested in gaming and hoping to find some of these games?
Well, all of the local game stores, and Milwaukee is very fortunate. We have a number of excellent, excellent game stores in hobby game stores and comic book stores that also carry hobby games in this area. The game stores are all willing to do orders for you. If you want a special order game, this is a great time to support local businesses. If you want to special order a game, contact them as early as possible. They are all happy to do special orders, or they can tell you whether they have a game in stock. You can also talk to them about other games that they may recommend. All of them have people working there who are hobbyists, who are game enthusiasts, and they are generally happy to share the games that they love with you. That would be a really terrific way for you to support local businesses, is reach out to those local game stores and give them your support.
All right. Well, James Lauder, thank you so much for joining us once again with your best games to gift, and have a happy new year.
Oh, you too, and a better 2021 for everyone.
Gaming expert James Lauder is the executive editor of Chaosium, and he joins us every year to talk about the best games to gift for this holiday season. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can find their full conversation with all of Lauder's recommendations at WUWM.com. Now that we've gone through games to gift, up next we'll return with Daniel Golden of Boswell Books for his annual Books to Gift conversation. Lake Effect Weekend continues on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's been an eventful year, to say the least, and it's getting closer to the season of giving. And what's a better way to show your love for friends and family than a tale they can dive into this winter? Books are a way we can connect with our loved ones, regardless of the distance between us. It's also a chance to step away from the screens that have now invaded the majority of our lives throughout this year and reconnect with a lasting form of entertainment. Boswell Book Company's Daniel Golden spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about just a few of his favorites.
We're coming up on the giving season, and one of my favorite gifts to both give and receive are books. So what are some of your recommendations for this season?
Well, we have a lot of, you know, we have a good amount of books, fortunately, that people keep publishing them. One of our big sellers this year is a book called Thinking Inside the Box by Adrian Raffel, because it's about the world of crossword puzzling. And so it turns out that a lot of people know if somebody does crossword puzzles. So that book is basically, I really enjoyed the book, but it definitely sells itself. A lot of people want escapism, so they're looking for, you know, fantasy or romance, or in terms of thrillers. There's a book called The Coyotes of Carthage that I really love, that I've actually talked about a bit. He lives in Madison. He's a political operative who's sent to South Carolina to basically throw an election so that they can unlock the mining rights in the town. And he's a Black man going into a very white town, so he has to have some boots on the ground, and he finds this evangelical Christian couple to sort of do his work, but they're kind of going their own way. And he's got a lot of also personal problems that he's dealing with. His girlfriend's left him. And so, and it reads almost like espionage. It's all in his head. Language is great. This guy, his name is Stephen Wright. He actually teaches both creative writing and law at University of Wisconsin. So I'm a big fan of that. So one book that's in a lot of top tens this year, this is a book called Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell. And like I said, it's on two of the major top tens of the year and won a major prize. And it is imagines the life of Shakespeare's family. And one of the interesting things about Shakespeare is that he lived through, to give it a parallel today, he lived through the plague. And but the plague is never mentioned in any of his plays. But his son died of the plague, and his son's name was Hamnet. And interestingly enough, Hamnet sounds a lot like Hamlet. And in fact, in Old English, it's the same name. So it's about Hamlet. Shakespeare himself is like a side character. It's about his wife and his two kids, both at the beginning of their marriage and also as the son has died. A beautiful book recommended to me by Jane Hamilton originally, the writer in Rochester. Just the kind of historical fiction where they're not just retelling history, they're trying to fill in the margins.
Yeah, it's probably not very common for Shakespeare to get a side role when talking about Shakespeare. So that's really interesting. What are some of the other, you know, books that reached the top of the charts this year or that you know people are really going to be gravitating towards?
The Vanishing Half by Britt Bennett was top 10 of the year in Washington Post, and I think number one fiction book of the year for Time Magazine, number one bestseller, followed up her first novel, The Mothers, which a lot of us liked. She actually came to Milwaukee, that was really fun. Nobody comes to Milwaukee now, but you know how that is. This book just came out at the right time in June and exploded. And it's the rare book that's incredibly well written. She's from the University of Michigan writing program, but also is a page turner. And it's about two sisters who are very light-skinned Black women. They grew up in a small town that eschews is very colorist. Like, the town is almost all Black, but there's definitely a preference for the lighter skinned, which is definitely a sort of maybe making social commentary on that. So these two girls grow up, and one of them leaves, and it turns out that she is passing for white. And the other woman marries, basically runs off too, but she marries the darkest man she can find. Divorces, comes back to town, and what happens, just really, like I said, so compelling and page-turning, but also hitting best book of the year list.
It's been a challenging year for most businesses, including places where community is built, such as a bookstore, for one. How has the publishing world responded to this eventful world we've been living in? Are there many pandemic-themed books vying for attention on your shelves?
No. It takes a long time to get books published. We actually had, you know, there have been books about old pandemics and the flu. John Barry, I think. I mean, this is kind of weird because after Katrina, I remember his book about the Mississippi River flood became a huge bestseller. And now his book about the flu became a bestseller. There are a few, there are definitely, but it takes a long time. Publishers are very worried about how long something will last. I mean, interestingly enough, with politics, they often don't seem to care, but with general nonfiction and especially with fiction, they get very worried. I've had a lot of authors talk about, some authors stopped writing and some authors can't stop writing in the pandemic, but a lot of them are struggling to figure out whether how they're going to incorporate the pandemic into their work. And when this is over, will people still want to read about it or not? You know, it's similar. I remember this with 9/11. It wound up being in a lot of books.
Let's talk about some of the best books for escapism this year. What are the best books for people to just get away from everything that's going on and dive into a different world or story?
But one book that actually three of my booksellers put in their top five is this book called They Convinced Me to Read It Too. It's called Hench by Natalie Zena Walschatz. And it is definitely escapism, though, interestingly enough, it still sort of touches on contemporary issues. It's about a young woman who works for a temp agency that supports supervillains. And she first goes to work for a very bad supervillain. But I don't mean bad like he's evil. I mean bad like he's a little incompetent. And she gets caught up in one of those rescue missions and is basically, while she's not doing any particular evil herself, she supports staff, she winds up in a hospital from collateral damage. And she starts this, she's a database manager by trade. Because, you know, you need office help. And she realizes, she starts doing these studies that show that actually supervillains cause less damage than superheroes. But superheroes are backed up by local government and police force, and so their destruction is acceptable destruction and destruction for the public good. So she winds up joining up with a much better villain. And by better, I don't mean less evil, but he runs an enlightened workplace and helps him kind of do some heavy conquering. So it's very much, you know, like it is sort of a look at policing and, you know, and what we think of as good and what we think of as bad. And she's, the author has definitely has a lot of interesting to say mixed in with all this action. As somebody who read a lot of comics when I was young and a staff that still reads a lot of graphic stuff, it's gone over very, very big with a lot of my staff.
That sounds like so much fun. If you read a lot of books, if you're interested in comic books, or if you watch those kinds of movies, I know it's a
conversation that I've always had with friends of mine after watching it. Like, gosh, you think about all that destruction that that hero caused. It's just one of those things that has been in conversation, and to actually see that those themes come into a book is really cool.
Yeah, I think this book is for you. And you don't want to talk to her. She's in, we host, Jason and I got to speak to her, and because we just chased it. You know, they weren't touring her, and, you know, virtually touring her. We just said, please, 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 please. And they said, okay. We had a great time, and she's super interesting. On the kid's side, there's a book that I just love, love, love so much called Skunk and Badger. This is Amy's pick for the year, our kids' fire. It's an early chapter book, so it's like 7 to 10, but it's ridiculous that there's an upper limit on this, because I could be 90 and still loving this book. Skunk and Badger are friends, or not friends, they're not friends at all. Badger does very important work with rocks. As you can, he is a rock categorizer, and he's been given this ability to live in this townhome by his aunt. One day there's a knock on the door, and Skunk arrives, who's also been given permission to live here. But this is ridiculous, because Badger has taken up the whole townhouse. Every square inch of space has a purpose. You know, there's a lot of boxes being stored, and this is, and on top of that, Skunk is so messy. And so there's an odd couple element. Skunk also has, Badger's a loner, but Skunk has a lot of friends. And his friends are all chickens. And the chickens are just invade the space. They're crazy. All kinds of chickens, every breed. And so they're going to have to learn to give, you know, they kind of get along in a way, but then they have a big fight and they learn to live together. What Amy Chamberlake is from, Wisconsin. She lives in Chicago now. She wanted to write a book like Winnie the Pooh. And on top of that, she has the amazing illustrator John Klassen, who wrote the I Want My Hat Back books, which are just spectacular. And she really captured it. Frog and Toad reminds me a little, you know, all those great friendship stories. And it reads aloud well. My friend was shopping at the store today, and she got it for her daughter, and she said, I don't want to read that book. And so they read it. Oh, let's just read a couple of books. And then later on, she's like, when are we reading that book again? So, love this book.
And what is a new series you're recommending to get others hooked on this holiday season?
I'm very excited about our local thriller writer, Nick Petrie. He's now on, I think, book number 1, 2, 3, 4. It's either 5 or 6. But what's exciting, the book's coming right after Christmas. He never gets to Christmas, because they always put him out paperback before Christmas. But he's his new book's set in Milwaukee, and it's The Drifter was his first book, and that was set in Milwaukee. But the new book, The Breaker, is way more Milwaukee-ish. I mean, there's lots of detail all over the place. And so it was a lot of fun. And it plays on the old thing about Milwaukee being the machine shop of the world. So some pretty killer machines come out of it. So I'm really excited about that. Right now, you know, the huge series book in science fiction or fantasy is Brandon Sanderson's new book, which, like, we sell him really well. We have a bookseller and staff who's like completely obsessed, but just, it's just like the new book just exploded. Like, we triple the sales. In terms of, you know, one of the things about series is, like, you don't really know it's a series everyone's gonna read until sometimes like book 2 or book 3. And sometimes you don't even know it's a series in book 1. You know, that's something that we're always learning. I'm guessing Hench, I'm pretty sure Hench is gonna have a sequel if it sells well enough. Just like Ready Player One, Ready Player Two, that came out much later. I know Murder at the Mina House already has a sequel, because it's already planning our launch for it. and in terms of the kids' world, there's gonna be 3 Skunk and Badger books. I'm not a big series person, but I bow to the fact that there are a lot of series people. Are you a series person?
I'm not always. I think I can't count the amount of times where I've read a book and then I come back like 5 years later and find out there's like 5 more books and that it is a series. That happens to me all the time. So it's off and on. I think that my tastes have changed to where I really gravitate towards nonfiction a lot more now than I used to, where I just used to gorge myself on young adult novels all the time. And I would just read them like they were candy. It's this constant.
One of the secrets of publishing is if you have a potential series in your head that you're writing, usually the first book does not end on a cliffhanger. The first book is self-contained because you don't know if there's going to be more. If the first book works, then you're much more likely to see the second book and going forward end on cliffhangers because they know it's going to keep going. So, but the first, that's why you can, you're like, that was a series? Because they actually try to write first books both ways.
That makes a lot of sense. And what are you suggesting, speaking of my gorging myself on young adult novels, what are you suggesting for the person who really enjoys those young adult novels and can't get enough of them?
We have a lot of young adult readers and we have a lot of recommendations. I actually do have this one adult book that I think crosses over. Actually, I have two, not I have more than two, but I have two, like one kind of has a fantasy element and one's contemporary, and they both cross over to high school, I think, really well. And certainly Colin. So the realistic one is called Everywhere You Don't Belong by Gabriel Bump, a book that came out last February. It's set in Chicago, in the south side of Chicago. And it's about this high school student who's kind of caught between the gangs and some police violence. But it's got this, you know, he's got this friend. Is she a friend? Is she a girlfriend? Who winds up moving in with her family when they can't live, you know, when they lose, they have some financial issues. It's got this Thelma and Louise-ish kindness to it at the end, because he tries to outrun the problems in Chicago by going to his campus school, state campus school in the small town. In the escapist side, I just love, as I think it's actually our book that had more like staff recs than anyone else. It didn't make as many top fives. It's called a book called We Ride Upon Sticks by Quan Berry. It is set in 1989 in outside of Salem, Massachusetts, in Danvers, which was actually a part of Salem. And it's about the girls' field hockey team in high school. And they're not doing very well. And they decide to inscribe a book of witchcraft to see if they can start winning games. And each chapter is a different focus of a protagonist and captures a different issue, and it's also a different match. And I just enjoyed it so much.
Daniel Golden is the proprietor of Milwaukee's Boswell Book Company. He joined Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel for our annual Boswell Books to Give segment, and you can find his entire list of book giving suggestions, including some that didn't make it on the air, at wuwm.com. And that wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered, coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.